Welcome to Season 7 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Daniel Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
All Play has brought back High Society. The game is a new edition of the well-acclaimed auction game, originally released in 1995. 3 to 5 players compete in auctions to gain points, point modifiers, and avoid negative cards. The player that bids the most after cross the entire game is eliminated. The remaining player that scores the most points wins. While the core game is largely unchanged, 3 new cards have been introduced to appeal to fans of the first printing. The cards were designed by original creator Dr. Reiner Knizia. Joe Wiggins, COO and co-owner of All Play, states, "The things I'm happiest about are the inclusion of a player aid that new players will find helpful, the 3 amazing advanced cards that really shake the game up, and better coding for the end game cards, card stats, and scandal cards." So check out High Society for $20 at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 137, A Place for All My Books. Today, we are joined by Mike Mihilsik, developer for Druid City Games, designer of games such as Flotilla, Off With Their Heads, and the upcoming Mountain Goats Legacy from All Play, which I know you all have heard me talk about. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be here.
Me too. I've only been harassing you for years to come on.
It only took me 136 other episodes to do it.
Yeah, is this 137? That was your number? You're just waiting for it?
Honestly, yeah, that was it.
Oh, perfect. Great. Well, I'm glad we got you on for the number that you clearly care so much about. I mean, also, I like to think that A Place for All My Books has been doing really well. Like, people are buzzing. It was, I'm pretty sure, a Barnes & Noble favorite for one of the months.
It's the Barnes & Noble Game of the Year for 2025, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, my bad.
Please, if you don't mind, let's...
No, that's amazing. I remember playtesting it a few years ago at the Gathering, and I was like, wow, this is really cool, super cozy. And I was playing it with Kurt, and then he mentioned who the designers are, and I was like, oh, no way, I love those guys. That's awesome.
I take back everything I said about it. I didn't know Mike designed it.
No, you know that's not it. I'm super excited to talk about this game. But before that, let's have some people learn about you. Who are you and how'd you get into designing board games?
Yeah, so I've been designing since probably about 2010 or so. I got into it and just worked on my first game. And then I was like, no, I don't think I'm ever going to stop doing this. So I just kept doing it. It took me a long time to make good games from the time that I made my first game. So there was a big gap there. You know, I started in like 2010 or so, 2011. And then my first contract was like in 2017 or so. So I spent a while as unpublished. And then from there, just kind of kept working on my craft. I've worked for a few game companies, and I also have done a lot of freelance work. So I've worked for Quick Simple Fun Games. I worked for Game Trays for a little while, and now I'm at Druid City, and it's lovely. Through the freelance projects that I've done, I worked with over a couple hundred clients over at Coalition Game Studios with a little development firm there, and worked with some odd, like, I don't know, 10 or 12 different major publishers. So had a nice time doing that. And but you know what? I'm very happy that I'm not freelance anymore, because that is a whole level of stress that I don't need in my life, Danielle.
I can relate to this. Yes. Granted, I tend to have a full-time and also freelance gigs because I'm crazy or I don't like sleeping. Well, it sounds like you got a lot of great experience from working with different publishers, either as a consultant or full-time. But now we're here at A Place for All My Books. Where'd that inspiration for that game come from?
Yeah, so I guess that one was kind of a, we Frankenstein that one together. This was a co-design with me and Alex Cutler. Alex Cutler has worked on a lot of different projects. He did like Expansity. He did Critter Kitchen, which was recently a pretty big hit. He's done a bunch of other stuff too. I got together with him. I moved to Raleigh a few years ago, Raleigh, North Carolina. Alex and I had known each other for a few years before that as well. And now once I moved into town, like, we knew that we both like to co-design games. So we kind of got together and we said, like, hey, you know, let's just go through our laundry. And you've done some co-designs as well. You're familiar with Laundry Day, right?
Like, here's a design I've wanted to make, can't seem to figure out how to do it, want to be my co-designer. Mm-hmm, it's like weird proposal.
Exactly right. So we're just sorting through our laundry baskets, and I had an old shell, like a little system that was cool and like had a nice little action loop but like the, it just didn't really ever go anywhere. Like the objective was kind of wonky. It was actually originally a game called Cold Fusion, where you were like scientists in the 90s trying to like generate an infinite amount of energy, but it kind of didn't really work like that. But there was like a nice little single worker placement sort of thing in there, where every action was kind of creating other opportunities for other players. So I had that little shell, and Alex showed me this game that at the time he was calling Sudoku, which is an ungoogleable Japanese word. It refers to kind of the practice of like collecting and amassing books without any intent to ever read them, which is a nice little charming kind of concept, right?
That makes hoarding sound nice.
right. So we had this concept of like all these little book tiles and stuff, and like arranging them in on like a little spatial grid and just trying to kind of hit objectives like that. And I said, well, and he didn't have a game around it. He just had like this cool concept and like a theme. And I said, well, let's just smash these together and see what happens, right?
No, I mean, it definitely happened, it sounds like. And also, fun fact, everybody who's listening, Alex was my very first guest on this show for Expand City. He also was the developer of Tricky Kids, so big fan of you both.
He was your first guest?
Yeah, he was my original number one, and you are 137.
That's especially funny because if I remember right, I think I met you and Alex at the same time.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, I also met both of you at the same time. I didn't realize you guys met each other at the same time. That game design retreat, I swear, is one that just keeps giving. Like, I have Charlie Bank and I's game coming out this year, or at least going to Kickstarter, and, you know, we met there too.
Yeah, right. Which one's that? Is it okay if I ask you about it?
This is a photography-themed game coming out from Inside Up that's going to be in the Earth universe. So, very excited.
Ooh.
Yeah, super pumped.
Did I play that one? I think I played it.
Did you play It's Like a Push Puzzle?
Yeah. You push the little tiles in. Yeah.
Yes, that one. We ended up signing it with Inside Up.
Yeah, awesome.
Excellent. Well, all right, sorry for that sidebar, but yes, Alex is great. You both are great. You made this game a place for all my books, but what, like, how do you actually play the game for anyone who hasn't played now?
Yeah, so Place for All My Books is it's a competitive 1-4 player game. There's a solo mode, of course, because why wouldn't you have a solo mode when it's a game about reading books, right?
And introverts.
Exactly, right. But you are you, and you have your little house, you have your collection of books, and you start with a few. Over the course of the game, you're going to be managing your own personal social battery. You're going to be building it up as you attend to different tasks around the house. You're going to be organizing your collection. You're going to be kind of turning in your own personal little goals that are based on kind of spatially how you're organizing those books in your house, and like really trying to get that feeling of satisfaction for meeting those goals, right? Those things are going to build up your social battery, and then you're going to go out into town. You're going to spend that social battery to visit, you know, strange, weird places like the bookstore and the library. And of course, that is going to be your means of getting more books. Your goal is to get points, but points are coming from books and from doing those objectives, and also just from like collecting other little things around your house, just other neat stuff cards they're called. It's a competitive game, but it's kind of cozy. It's not like super intense or anything like that. It's meant to be a bit relaxing, you know, give you a nice little puzzle, but without all the stress.
Yeah, I've very much enjoyed it. And as an extrovert, I have now won it 3 times, which maybe feels wrong.
Look what you've taken from us.
I know. I am so sorry. But I've also gifted it to my introverts. So like, do I get points for that at least?
No, no, absolutely not.
Great. Awesome.
You have to give those points back. It's not for you.
I do think it's really cool, the idea of mixing. I mean, you definitely inject the cozy. The art is cozy. The idea of collecting books, the like being home and the not really wanting to go out, but like building up that energy by just organizing and feeling good and cozy in your own space. I think it's really interesting how you tied the theme in with the mechanics, especially since it came from Frankenstein and concepts. Was that really important to both of you while you were working on the game?
Yeah, I mean, like it really came from that original spirit of like, you know, being in your house, that introverted experience. And as we built the prototype out, I think we always had the social battery in there. We always had it. But as we started pitching the game, it became a little bit less of just like, oh, we're just kind of referring to these things. And once we put it in front of Kurt at Smirk and Dagger, the publisher for the game, once we put it in front of him, he was like, I know who's going to like this game. And I think that there is a whole identity here. Like, this is an introvert looking at this game and saying, like, you see me. So it kind of shifted away from being like, oh, this is just a gentle reference, into like, this is an identity game, right? Like, this is made for, you know, people who really get that satisfaction from collecting things and curating their own personal space
And then they, you know, again, the social battery there is like the biggest thing that people see that and they say, oh, I know exactly what that's like. I have to spend 3 days at my house before I'm ready to go to the library again.
No, I mean, because like I said, extrovert here, playtesting it, I immediately messaged people going, oh my God, this game, you're going to need to buy it, or I'm going to buy it for you. It was one or the other. And I'm not someone who backs deluxe versions of things, but I actually did get the deluxe version of your guys's game when it went to Kickstarter. I was like, done, instant buy, because I enjoyed it, but it was also just everyone I've taught it to. And I've taught this game without playing it, actually, which there's only a few games that ends up happening at conventions. For some reason, your game last year was that one for that year. The year before was Rock Hard. But basically, like, every time I teach it, you can just like see people love playing with the little books and they get so much joy and they relate so much to it. And it's like very interesting how the theme really does carry through and like cause like good feelings, which I don't see as often in games. So great job.
Thank you very much.
This podcast isn't about making you feel good, but you know, yes, good job.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. No, that was definitely like, you know, intended from the start, but you know, yeah, really, like I said, we really focused in on it once Kurt sort of identified that. I think one of the questions that Alex and I really asked ourselves throughout this process was like, what is a cozy game? Like, what makes a cozy game? And I don't know if we answered that perfectly with A Place for All My Books, because I've definitely seen some reviewer reactions and stuff like that that have been like, this isn't a cozy game at all, right? Which, you know, I totally makes sense, because there is there are some elements there, which, you know, we can talk about that. But it was our intention to like really, really discuss and like have a heartfelt talk about like what makes a cozy game. So I want to ask you about that too, because like, do you, you know, you've mentioned the word cozy, and like, I feel like in the last couple of years, like we've heard a lot of people talking about like, what is a cozy game? Now that we're in the post Everdell world.
Yeah. Right?
But, you know, how about for you? Like, did you feel like this game was cozy in its experience? Like, obviously it's intending to be cozy in its presentation and in its like its intended narrative, but like, was the experience cozy for you?
To me, yes. I felt like as a package, I know when I say cozy, it's a combination of kind of art aesthetics, but also it's in what I'm doing. And yes, you are competing against each other. But as far as like player interaction goes, most of your interaction is going to be when you're out in town, which feels appropriate because you are building your energy to go and, you know, be around other human beings. But I like the fact that you can get popped out of a space and then you're put into like the park or whatever, which is kind of cute. And it's like you actually get some of your energy back because you can't choose to go there, but you can be pushed into going there, which is kind of fun. It almost makes me think like you see your ex in a bookshop and you're like, oh no, or the library, and you're like, I gotta go. And then you're hiding in the trees and watching a dog or something. So yeah, for me, the experience of picking up and relocating and doing the little puzzle on the board feels cozy. It feels like very zen for me, but I'm also a fan of spatial puzzles and I like stacking random objects. I like the tactile feel. Like that calms me. I could see how maybe for someone else that's not how they recharge, but like for me, I recharge doing those kinds of things.
Yeah, I feel like I do too. For context, the you have the spatial grid on your board. You have these stacks of these little book tiles. And you have these little goal cards in your hand, and each of them is like, you know, if you look at each individual goal card, it's usually really simple to satisfy the conditions on that card. Like, oh, you want to have, you know, the blue books on top of like four different stacks. You want to have, you know, a couple big stacks that have two different color books in them, whatever it is. Like those things are usually not going to be very stressful or like intimidating to do. But the catch is that when you go to turn in objectives, that's your turn, that's your action for the turn, you can complete as many of those that you can do at the same time. So you're trying to kind of find those intersections and sort of take those organizational actions more efficiently in ways that will be able to satisfy multiple objectives at once, right?
Yeah. And for me, I do relate a lot to that in being efficient in my own house. I'll listen to the podcast while I am cooking dinner and then I'll be eating dinner, but while reading emails or whatever it is. So like in a different way, I can relate to that feeling of being like productive in your home and that actually kind of recharging your battery in a way. It's kind of weird, but that's me too.
For sure. And like, I think in the core audience for the game, I think a lot of people that look at this game and they're like, oh, I feel seen by this game. They're also satisfied by that puzzle where they can say, oh, okay, I'm just going to kind of do this and then do this. I'm going to plan this out. I'm going to find a way to do this little Sudoku, right? And then like once they do that, they get that little feeling of satisfaction. It kind of boosts up their social energy, right? But at the same time, like if you peel back the layers, you really look at it, it is an efficiency and optimization puzzle. Right? Like you're trying to do these things in the fewest number of, you know, moves or turns or whatever it is that you can so that you can kind of keep up the pace with other players. So there is still tension. Like we didn't want the game to be without tension, but I do feel that like tension is kind of, it works contrary to the concept of being cozy and super comfortable, right? Because there is always like, there's a clock ticking there.
For sure. I also think because your actions are so quick, because there's only one thing you're really doing on your turn, that also helps drive the feel of being a little more cozy. And like, yes, there is that tension, but it's pretty snappy, so it can almost be like missed. I mean, I can see the argument. I guess for me, it still fits in cozy, because I think of like Roberta Taylor, a lot of her games, like Creature Comforts, people think of it as like cozy, but it's actually a pretty strategic game. It really feels aesthetic wise more, where your gameplay feels more cozy than her gameplay does, even though I feel like she is known as the cozy game designer, which I find very funny because she's made a war game before. No one seems to know that.
Was it a cozy war game?
No. And the game we're working on, there's like patients dying in it, so like, and yet people are like, oh my god, it's cozy, and I'm like, what is happening? If right. This woman's attached to a project, it's apparently cozy now.
Yeah, it's getting typecast now, right?
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I get that sometimes. I'm the party game girl and I'm like, I make more than just party games. Just saying.
I love thinking about that question now because like I do think that like, you know, the more tense a game is, probably the less cozy some people are going to find it. So like, you know, I guess I don't know if the game design culture of January 2026 has really like come up with a perfect answer to like what is the best practice for a cozy game, right? But I do think that like we answered a lot of those other questions and I like the answers that we found. I feel really confident. That one I'm not sure. Like I personally like it, but I can see where, you know, where else it may not come through. But like for us, you know, obviously like narrative, presentation, that sort of thing, like we want everything to be comforting. Nothing should be too bold or it shouldn't kick you in the head whenever you open the box, right? You know, we really wanted to make sure that the things that you're building and developing, that no other player has a chance to destroy that, right? Like we didn't want like hostile interactions. We didn't want like, oh, I can't believe you just did that to me. You know, you should feel comfortable. You should feel safe when you're playing this game, right? If you're building something like that, should feel like it's not within the reach of other players to disrupt. And honestly, you shouldn't really want to disrupt the other players too. And it doesn't feel cozy either, right? So yeah, we knew we wanted that. And then another choice that we made, I would almost never make in any of my other game designs. Like in if I'm playing a strategy game or if I'm making a strategy game, I would never do it like this. But we wanted there to be very little feedback in the game state, right? So there's no victory point tracker. We're not trying to like, we're not seeing who's ahead and trying to base that or planning around that. In fact, you know very, very little about your score until the end of it. And you can kind of eyeball it a little bit. Like, you know that books are points, right? You know the completed goals are a couple points. You know that you're going to score the cards on the other neat stuff in front of you. So you can, if you really want to, you can get a running tally, or you can kind of have just like an intuitive idea of who's doing well and who's not. But I find that a lot of the people that play this, they're just heads down. They're like, I just want to solve the next piece of this puzzle. I just want to get books. And I feel like that having very little feedback and reporting from the game has really helped that kind of cozy angle.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because that kind of makes me think of when someone talks about a party game being successful. It has a scoring system, but you ignore it because you're just having fun. And so it's almost that idea of it's cozy, you're having fun, so you're not caring about how the score works. And then at the end, you're like, oh, wait, yeah, that's a thing we're doing this whole time. And were there any design changes the two of you made as you were developing the game?
This one, actually, it came together really quick. We started working on it. Let's see, when I moved to Raleigh, it was like around June. And then I think we showed it to Kurt at Metatopia in November for the first time. He had a couple of requests, and then we showed it to him at PAX the next month in December. And that's when we got a verbal on it, and we got the contract the next month after that. So from concept to contract, it was about, 5-6 months?
That's amazing. And what year was that?
I want to say 22, 23 maybe.
Okay. And then the game came out last year?
Yeah, kickstarted in 25, in winter of 25.
Yeah, it was literally in my top 20. What am I talking about? Yeah, it was last year. It's just because I played it the year before and I was like, wait a second, I got to think this one through.
So yeah, like the cycle on it was pretty quick. I think the biggest changes that we made, like I mentioned that I had that kind of Cold Fusion mechanical shell, and I had played that game a lot in, you know, the previous years. So like the systems were already feeling pretty good. That was a big head start on it. The rest of the time that Alex and I spent between that that June and that November, it was mostly on just like fine tuning stuff, right? We were just kind of like, oh, let's, trying to work the spatial puzzle. Like what exactly are the organizational actions that you should have access to, right? What are the goal cards that are just too hard or too easy, or like, you know, trying to stumble into them or whatever. Like, you know, we're trying to curate the decks and stuff like that and the effect suite. So like, you know, it didn't take a super long time. But once we showed it to Kurt, we really had that kind of realization I mentioned earlier, which was this is a lifestyle game, right? And this isn't just like a, oh, it's a board game, but it happens to be about books. It's like, no, this is the book game. And really like leaning into that angle and redesigning the game in a way that it was sort of inviting to that audience, to that very specific audience, and sort of, you know, allowing that personality to come through in the design. I think that's where a lot of the changes came in.
Oh, that's great. I don't remember what I told him, but I know I gave him feedback.
So it was all your fault.
Yeah, my bad that you got a best of the year award. Actually, I'll take credit for this. You're right. It was all me. You did nothing. So did you two set out to work with Merc and Dagger, or did it just happen to be that he was at Metatopia, you had the game, he played it?
It was, yeah. Actually, Alex ended up going to Metatopia that year. I stayed home, and Alex was like, "I'm gonna show it to Kurt." And you know, of course, Kurt, you know, his publisher imprint is Smirk and Dagger. And if you look at a lot of his games from, you know, 2022 and before, a lot of them had, you know, a lot of hostile interactions. A lot of them were, you know, Kurt's someone who takes a lot of delight.
Yeah, Nightcage versus this, very different vibes.
Yeah, exactly. Right, Cutthroat Caverns, is that Smirk and Dagger?
Maybe. He's been putting out a lot of games.
Yeah, but then also like he sort of shifted in like around that time and started saying like, you know, well, I think he made was it Before There Were Stars? That was also designed by Alex and another co-designer there. So like, you know, at the time he was looking at sort of making, you know, some lighter, more accessible games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember for a bit he had that imprint of Smirk and Laughter, and then he brought it back in and he's like, yeah, we're just gonna keep Dagger for everything.
Now we're not doing that anymore.
We have this. Yeah,
so like when you know, at the time I remember being kind of surprised. I was like, oh, you're just gonna show it to Kurt? Okay, sure. And then Kurt, you know, turns out Kurt loved it. He was a really big fan. So I don't even know if we pitched it to anyone else. I think it was just Kurt, and he was like, I like this.
That's interesting. Okay, so like designer to designer, are you the kind of person that if you get that one enthusiastic feedback from a publisher, because it sounds like you still did additional work and then showed it again, are you someone who's like, now I'm going to stick with this enthusiastic publisher? Or are you like, oh my God, I got to show it to more publishers? Like, what line do you tend to fall on? And I'm not saying like specifically with Kurt, but it could have been any publisher.
Gosh, I'm the wrong person to ask this. I don't take this advice to any new designer that's out there. Don't listen to me here that when I'm going to say this. But like to me, gosh, the less I have to pitch, the better. You know?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
I'm not doing any more legwork.
It's a lot of energy and time.
If someone's interested, I'm like, good. Thank you.
Money, please.
They're like, oh, we're only going to give you 5%. I'm like, that's fine. And I realize that's, again, that's not good advice, but for me personally, like that's the worst part. I hate just like tugging on people's sleeves and saying like, oh yeah, let me get a minute of your time. I was so happy that Alex was the one doing that. That's the best part of our partnership.
Do you tend to do that with other co-designers where the other person's pitching, or do you kind of mix it up?
The only other person that I've done a published co-design on, the main one that's coming to mind is JB Howell, who co-designed Flotilla with me. And, we've done a few other co-designs as well that I think some of those are still coming out. Off With Their Heads is also a JB and Mike special. So like for me and JB, JB is like a tree. Like he has the mannerisms and the personality of a tree.
I have met him, but he's so lovely.
Right, exactly. So like neither of us are like, you know, super, super outgoing or whatever, but we both, you know, we've known people in the space for a number of years. So like, it's just whoever happens to have those connections or make that pitch, then that's, we're happy to go with that. I think we've been about 50-50 on that one. But Alex, man, I'm always happy just to dump all that on Alex's lap.
That's normally me as the co-designer. We'll go through a spreadsheet, come up with like a bunch of people to pitch it to, and then they'll put their name next to one or two out of 20, and the rest are for me. And I'm like, excellent.
We should co-design something.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
You do all the stuff I don't want to do, and I'll do all the stuff you don't want to do.
You know, I think that works sometimes, but I think it really depends on the project. I don't know if I'm always the best person to pitch it to, because if you know the person, the publisher, a lot of times it's better for the person who actually knows them to do it versus cold calling, because I have cold called many and not gotten responses. So even if you're someone who has published games out there, you'll still not get an answer. That's not just newbies. But yeah, no. And then, I mean, component-wise, the game looks great. Did you get any say on art or components while working with Smirk and Dagger?
They did show us some of the components as they were being made. I don't know if Alex and I, like, I mean, the what you see is pretty much what we saw at the time. So, like, we were obviously pretty happy with it. Like, we love the way that the game looks and the aesthetic and stuff. I don't know if we were, like, invited to, like, you know, give meaningful feedback or be like, oh no, we veto this. I don't know if that invitation was ever extended to us, but we didn't have that feedback anyways, so it was easy to navigate.
Very cool. How involved do you like to be with the publisher once something's signed? Are you more like, I hear this kid is out of my basement, or are you I'm gonna keep working with them?
You know, I've done it both ways. I think personally, like, now that I've had more work on my plate, I really prefer to be hands off now. In my first few signed designs, I was like, yeah, anything you need, I'm here. You know, you want a round of development, I'll make any changes you want. You want me to be involved in the art process? Great. And now it's like, I can do those things if you want. I remember for Flotilla, that was one where JB and I were like super involved, because that was when Zev was at WizKids. We were very involved in that process. Like, kind of, we like generated art prompts for the illustrators. We like helped line up the illustrators. You know, we were often like kind of giving the,
almost like a project manager, it sounds like,
a little bit. Yeah, like we did a little bit of that. So there was, you know, there was a lot there, and in the end, I think that kind of came back to bite us, because we had a couple things that we missed, and there wasn't like a lot of other oversight. So like, we had a couple misprints, and we had a card that didn't do what it was supposed to, that led to like an infinite combo in the first printing. So that was that was a little embarrassing, but like, you know, it's at the same time, like, it was also really cool to be that involved with the production of that game, right? Because I do think that, like, I mean, Flotilla as a game, as like as a product, really looks and feels kind of a step up from some of the other games that came out that year through WizKids. So we were really happy with it, except for the things that we missed, right?
Yeah. Honestly, more eyes on things, always a good call. I was so mortified when the first printing of Tricky Kids came out and there was like two typos I saw. And I was like, what are you doing? Because we pointed them out, because, you know, the publisher in our contract had it where they have to send us files. And they were really good. Like, they sent a lot of art. I would give feedback. Same with Steven. But we gave feedback. We got the rule book like right before they're going to print. They're like, we're sending this to print basically tomorrow. Oh, and we're like, yeah. Wait, there's these problems. They did not get fixed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was more embarrassing on the rule book writer than us or the graphic designer. I mean, combination. Because one, you could tell, was more of a graphic thing, and the other was more of a rule book, right? But I mean, either direction, it should have been caught or just changed off of what we gave them to change. So we keep being like, hey, as a reminder, please make sure to make these changes in that second print run we're doing. Because I think it's even more embarrassing if it's a second print run with the same typos. I'm like, please, please. No, it is cool though, because when you get to see more of how the sauce gets made, it's only going to make you a better designer or cook.
And honestly, like, if an error like that makes it through to the second print run, it's part of the game now.
Yeah, there you go.
Forget about it.
Yep, then it's just an Easter egg for someone to find.
right.
No, totally. And when you guys were kind of like working on the game, was there anything that you had in the original design that you pitched that got cut out? Or did everything kind of just like stay the same and it was more balancing past that point?
You know, I feel like there was, and I'm having a little bit of trouble thinking of it. I was trying to think of like some specific examples of the stuff that, that, you know, the input that Kurt had and like the changes that we made as a result of that. I do remember, like, I mean, for us, like, the biggest change was framing the energy, which I think we might have just called it energy in our first draft, framing that as like literally just social battery. And like, that was in our, original rulebook as like, oh, this resource is like, it's like your social battery. And Kurt's like, no, we're going to call it that because that's the thing that people are going to connect with. You know, I watched the game being pitched at, you know, to convention goers, right, from the booth. And that's the point that people respond to is like, so you're going to spend your social battery to do that, to go into town. And everyone goes, oh
my God. I can like picture how he says it, where he has almost like a little smirky. I picture it. Yep. Amazing. And did you have a favorite and least favorite part of the design journey for this game?
I'm trying to think of any unpleasant parts behind it. I'll tell you one thing. It was trying to figure out the end condition for the game. This is kind of something that like, I ultimately don't think we made the wrong choice. And I think it's like, I like where it ended up and I think it's appropriate for the game, but there's a part of me that like in my heart, like I, you know, a lot of my other games are just like strategy games. Right. And I'm like, no, if this game is going to end, it needs to end in a way that is concrete and, you know, mostly predictable and is controllable. There can't be anything that's like, you know, any loose screws in this.
I can see now why the current form of it is very different from what you're describing. Okay. Yeah, maybe right. Talk about how the game ends and how rounds kind of work.
Right. So at the start of the game, based on your player count, you're going to set the sun tracker on a certain space. And every time someone takes the action to leave their house, you're going to move that sun tracker down. And once it gets to the end of the track, you are going to go through the end game procedure where you finish the current round. Everybody gets one full turn after that, and then you go to final scoring. It's a player-based game clock, and players actually have a lot of influence over it. And like the strategy game designer in me looks at that, and I'm like, okay, the longest possible game is this, the shortest possible game is this, right? And it doesn't matter what like the mean, you know, is it matters like that is, you know, how wide is that, you know, bell curve distribution in those game endings? How many times are we going to see a game that ends, you know, too short and lasts way too long? And, you know, if it's 1 in 100 times and you sell 100,000 copies of it, right, then that means like there's going to be thousands of people that play this game. And they're going to be like, this was terrible, right? Depending on like on how bad those endings are. And like in this, I didn't feel like there were like terrible endings, but I did feel like there was just that gap between shortest and longest possible game was just a little too wide for my comfort. Now, like in the game, players are really kind of incentivized to play along certain ways. And like, you're generally not going to, you know, get a little bit of social battery and run to town and do nothing and then run back, right? You're usually going to build up your social battery and then be like, okay, now I'm going out into town, right? The game, like, not only narratively, but also mechanically kind of nudges you towards that line of play. But it's still possible to, like, I'm going to take one action at my house. I'm going to go into town. I'm going to tick down the game timer and then I'm going to come right back, right? And if everybody does that, then not really anybody did very much. So, like, you know, part of me, I struggle with that. I was like, you know, I'm like laying out the numbers and I'm looking at Kurt and Alex and I'm like, guys, I think we got a problem. Right. And, but you know, it's also not a complaint that I've seen in reviews or in forums and stuff like that. Every once in a while, you're like, oh, the game ended too soon because we all stayed at our house and we just did goals and did our puzzle instead of going into town. Like, we never went into town. Right. So like, sometimes you see people that have those bits of feedback. But like, for the most part, like, it's not really something that I'm seeing very often. And like, ultimately, I think it's like the way we have the game timer as it is now is like, it's not bad. Like, it's, you know, it's clear what's going to happen. It's an intuitive timer. But like, there is still part of me that I'm like, I'm a little afraid, right? I'm afraid of like, like the Dice Tower is going to be doing a live play of it. And they're like, this game's lasted forever. Right. And that's in my best Tom Vassell voice. So, you know, there's still that worry in me, but I'm hesitantly happy with how it went.
No, I mean, I could definitely see that. And it's interesting because sometimes you feel like you have the best solution or you have the best solution for the time. And for me, especially with strategy games, some of them are so hard to figure out how to actually win and how to end the game. Because you might have this epic mechanic or combo of mechanics that's very satisfying, but you don't want the game to overstay its welcome or end too short. And having an end game like this, you run both of the anxiety-inducing potentials. Mm-hmm. And you just hope that the spirit of the game is going to keep people in the optimal time to play, which it sounds like in most cases, it's okay and it works out. But occasionally you're going to have some of the edge cases.
Right, for sure. There's some backup game timers, like if you run out of cards in the gold deck or whatever, like if nobody just ever goes to town and you just do the gold cards, like then, you know, if you run, once you run out of cards, then it's the game ends there. But that takes longer at a lower player count than it does at a higher player count. So,
No, totally fair. And then, so flip side, what was your favorite part of designing the game?
When I cashed the first royalty check, I think that was my
favorite. I love that answer.
That was my favorite part.
Way to be honest.
That was a good moment. Yeah. Right. No, I think for me, it was really satisfying to just take that mechanical model that I mentioned earlier and then Alex's kind of narrative model. And there was a moment we were sitting at the table and Alex kind of pointed it out. And I was like, ooh, what if we, and just, I'm kind of doing like the mental, you know, arithmetic in my head. I'm like, wait, what if we did this? What if we did this? And I was like, Alex, I'm going to send you a Google Doc later tonight. I think I have it. It's kind of hard to explain. I still got to kind of, you know, capture some of this in my mind and kind of pin it down. But I think I might have this. He was like, okay. So I just went home and I just like typed out a rule book. And if we look at that initial rule book, it's really not all that different from the final version. And just like that like jumping that gap was like just a fun and satisfying moment. Cause I felt like Alex and I together found the bridge between our concepts and just you know, crossing that gap was that was fun.
Yeah, I feel like that doesn't happen all that often. Mm-hmm. And especially so smooth.
Right. Yeah. Like a lot of times, like I always really hope for that first table test to be like, this is going to be playable. It's going to be fun right from the start. But like, even in times you're like, I think I got a spicy one. Sometimes you just get one at the table and you're like, ah, dang it. Almost had it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This one was like, you know, we played it for the first time. We're like, yeah, I know exactly what we need to change, but the next version, this is already fun. And I know exactly where we want to go from here.
Yeah. That's always a really nice feeling when you feel like the core is there and everything else is mostly going to be tweaking cards and coming up with additional components, you know, to hit whatever count that the person needs, the publisher. And do you have any big like takeaways from this experience in particular?
I mean, I think my biggest takeaway was seeing how a really specific audience reacts to seeing this representation of them and their passions in a board game. I've worked on a lot of strategy games and like in all my other games that I've kickstarted and that I've worked on and that contributed to, if you look at like the backer breakdown, they can tell you like how many people are like first time Kickstarter backers, right? It's usually like it's a minority, like right? It's not a ton of them. For a place for my books, there was like an overwhelming majority of people. They had never backed to Kickstarter before. And they were like, I came here because I saw, you know, this thing on, you know, book talk, right? And they were like, I saw this and I came here and like, maybe I'll get into board games to try this out. Right. So like, you know, really tapping into those niche things, those cultural corners, that people are like really passionate about, and then leveraging that to profit.
Oh, well, yes, clearly. No, but it's awesome. Those audiences like do really cross over. I know with the end of the year having happened fairly recently, I saw so many, this is my recap of games I played in 2025, but also here's the books I read or the audiobooks I listened to. I was seeing both from like the same creators and was like, oh, okay. We're all a bunch of, nerds, let's be honest here. Nerds right. And geeks, but we love it.
Right in the center of that Venn diagram is the Kallax, right? Like that.
Yes. Multi-purpose.
Yes. It's right there at the core of it all.
Might even put a cat in there. Wow. And you've been pretty busy. I mean, you've got some cool stuff coming out. Any projects you're allowed to talk about?
Yeah. So pretty soon as of the recording of this, but I think probably in the past now of the airing of it, will be Mountain Goats Legacy. That one's coming to Kickstarter on, I think it's launching January 13th.
Yep. So that will have been over by the time this launches.
Yeah. And I hope it went really well.
Oh, I'm sure. I have a feeling it will because I used to always say that the Mountain Goats game was like one of my first all-play game. It actually might have been my first one that Ben from Unpub played with me. But yeah, no, I really liked it. And the idea that they turned it into that you turned it into a legacy game, I don't even understand how you did that.
Yeah. The first time I sat down and played Mountain Goats, I remember reading through the rule book and I was like, I'm too cool for this game. I was like, I play real games. This one's not going to have anything for me. But then you sit down and play it for like 5 minutes. And you're like, this is really cool. this is just good, kind of chaotic fun. It's just super straightforward. You know, every turn is like, you know, nail biting. It just feels good. It's just like such a simple game. So like I really did a 180 on Mountain Goats within the space of like 2 minutes. And, and I'm glad I did, because, I think we actually, started working on that one. That's another co-design with me and Alex Cutler, who did, was co-designer on A Place for All My Books. So it's, another dynamic duo game. But we started working on that after we had been pitching Joe a couple games, and we're like, well, what are you looking for? And I feel like he just looked us right in the eyes. Like, I want Mountain Goats Legacy.
That also sounds like Joe.
Right. And we were like, yeah, we can do that. So, you know, y'all will see, you know, more about the systems and stuff in there. But like, we really wanted to base this one around the concept of like, it's a family legacy game. So we want people to be able to just like come and go as they please. We want there to be like no real stakes. You know, every session has its result, and like, you're going to keep score or whatever. You're going to keep track of who wins. But the only meaningful thing there, it's not like, oh, you're the supreme champion of all the mountains or whatever. It's just, you know, you're going to write this stuff down, and like, it tells just a slightly different story at the end based on all these results. And we wanted to frame this around the idea of like a children's book, where there's a branching path, and like, you know, you have this journey that this family of goats is going on. Every new chapter in the story is just a different crossroads where, you know, yes, we're trying to climb to the top of these mountains, but like, now we're on this journey to our new home by the sea, and we're trying to kind of overcome these obstacles and kind of, you know, get there together. It's just like a nice, wholesome story. Like, it's feel good, but also like kicking people off of mountaintops too.
I was going to say, is there going to be a troll involved?
No troll, but maybe some other beasties. Who knows? No spoilers.
Okay. Yeah, no spoilers. It's the one thing about legacy games, I guess. Very cool. Well, I'm glad that the dynamic duo got to sink their teeth into a game that I enjoy and make it a very different type of game that I've still actually never made it through a full legacy game. So I'm hoping someday I'll find the one that I get through. Maybe it'll be your guys's. Maybe it'll be not yours. Who knows? Or I'll give up. Who knows?
We played a whole campaign with a full player count of 5, and I think we did it in one sitting, which is a little bit exhausting. I would probably want to break it up over a couple days if I were playing in real life, but like, you know, I think that session, it probably only lasted like 6 or 8 hours. You know, it's a pretty quick game.
I mean, yeah, that's actually not that bad. But when you say 6 or 8 hours, it's like, oh wow, that is a long session. It's like a work day. But right, honestly, yeah. I'd rather do that than most work days. So
it's like, yeah, it's a couple, right. It's a couple game nights. Right. You do it over a weekend.
Perfect. And any other games?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to remember which ones I have coming up and which ones I'm allowed to talk about. There's Off With Their Heads, which as of this recording, it is just now starting to ship. It's available through All Play's web store. That one's published by Druid City Games. That is a flip and write, sort of. It's actually like a simultaneous reveal and write, where everyone reveals a card from their hand, and then you compare those cards to each other based on a certain hierarchy, and then you make a mark based on whatever card you played, but the mark goes in a zone depending on how it ranks compared to other players' cards. So it's kind of an and write game where you're trying to arrange marks, plays in like 30 minutes, really super easy to learn, but has just a lot of lines of play that you can kind of explore, and a lot of ways you can kind of fill out your sheet. So that one's coming soon, right to retail.
Nice. No dealing with the Kickstarter stuff.
Yeah, please.
I am about to experience Kickstarter for the first time, like as a designer. I've actually never had any of my games on Kickstarter. I know.
How have you dodged it?
I do not know. Yeah. As of this recording, I have 10 published games and none of them are on Kickstarter. So
you just, I think you made the right choice of pitching to publishers that have cash lying around.
There you go.
That was the right choice you made.
Yeah, I mean, I am looking back, I'm like, oh yeah, I guess some of them did, but others kind of ish a little bit. I don't know, I got lucky. Maybe we'll see how this first experience of having a Kickstarter goes. Hopefully it'll be good, especially because Charlie is my co-designer on it. So
yeah. When is that Kickstarter?
They had said that they were aiming for Earth Day, which feels very appropriate.
Okay, so like what, the 22nd of April? It's a Wednesday.
That seems right. We'll see how that goes, but hoping for the best. Now, for my last question, though, of this podcast, unrelated to everything we just talked about, I want to know if you could magically have been the designer of a game you didn't design, which one would you choose?
Ooh, okay. I imagine you probably had the same experience where, like, you sit down, you play a game, and it's, like, just so, like, sharp and clever where, like, your first reaction before you realize that it's fun, before anything else, your first reaction is like, ah, why didn't I make this?
Yep.
Like, yeah, come on. What's going on here? Mm-hmm. For me, I think I have a couple of those games, even though they're not even games that I like, that I play all the time, or like, I, you know, not always like at the top of my to play list, but there's still games that I rank like a 10 out of 10, just because I'm like, this is just so smart. Like, why not me? Right. And those games for me, Hanama Koji. Have you ever played that one? It's a little bit like Battle Line, where you're playing different cards one at a time, like just through this little, you know, light action selection system. But it's just like so smooth, so elegant. It's just it's a brilliant game. Hanama Koji. And then the other one for me is For Sale. For Sale is it's just brilliant, right? Like, it's so good.
It is very clever, especially for the time it came out.
Yeah, right? 100 years ago or whatever.
No.
In the distant past.
Before I started playing games, but no.
Yes. The pre-Danielle era.
Yeah, no, we're not starting that. I can totally relate to that, though. There's so many games that... Because when I think of this question, it's like, is it one that I think I could have designed? Or is it one that I'm just like envious of? Or yeah, the money grab. So I'm always curious to see what the designer picks, so...
Yeah, right. You know, another one is No Thanks. I think No Thanks is so smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's usually just like small games that are just like just big feelings. Those are usually the ones that I find myself envying.
Granted, I've played the German copy of No Thanks, and it has really fun illustrations. So anyone who's a fan of No Thanks, look it up. It's like kind of messed up illustrations of, I don't want to say death and dismemberment, but like some weird cartoon shenanigans. Very entertaining.
Nine Danka or whatever it is they call it.
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm so curious how they went with that look there. And then in the States, it's just like pretty basic graphic design, no illustration really. But sure, way to go, amigo. Well, everyone, thanks so much for joining our shenanigans. And this episode, the number that Mike is so obsessed with, episode 137, A Place for All My Books. And you know, Mike, thanks for being here after me harassing you for years.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun. Maybe I'll see you on episode 274.
Definitely not. No, I don't do repeats. Sorry. Yeah.
Oh.
I know. And Alex, unfortunately, got there first. So he like has had a lot of good stuff coming out. So, I mean, he probably regrets that decision too. Nah, but if anyone's trying to find you online or check out your games, is there a spot they can look for you?
I don't think so, no. I think just search for Board Game Designers on BGG and just look for Mahilsik, because that one's really easy to spell. There's only one of me.
That's true.
So, yeah, that's where you find all my stuff that I designed. And then in the meantime, I'm still working full-time over at Druid City Games, so keep an eye on us for sure. A lot of really cool stuff coming up in the pipeline.
Cool, yeah. And I'm guessing Instagram, Facebook, all that for them.
Yeah.
Perfect. And I've been your host. I'm Danielle Reynolds. And if you're trying to find my personal social media, you can check me out under Token Gamer, spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R, mostly on Instagram. And then I've been doing those fun short form videos for this podcast, Game Design Unboxed, featuring designers talking about cool games that they made, or just giving tips to help y'all figure out how to start designing games and get to the point where, you know, Mike's cashing in those awesome checks. And then I guess I could be found on BGG. I should really remember that one. But I appreciate you being on here. All jokes aside, this game has been super fun. I've enjoyed playing it, and I've enjoyed learning more about the Frankenstein that started it all.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, inspiration to publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out allplay at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.